Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you register for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Northwest Arkansas. Chad, we did it last year. Grab those tickets to the Northwest Arkansas event because it was loads of fun last year. It's going to be loads of fun this year. Great speakers, great music, great food, great fellowship. It's going to be a good time. It's only $99 for the two-day event. And you get to like hang out in beautiful downtown Bentonville, which you might be like, I don't know what that is. But trust me, it's cool. You can walk everywhere. It's got that old-school Americana feel to it, but lots of stuff to do. It's a good time. Beautiful area. That's why I live here. Come hang out with Chad and me. And a whole bunch of other people. You can get all the information over at 1517.org. Just go to the events page, click on that event, see all the great stuff, and then register. And I'll put a link in the show notes. So you just scroll down from the episode, and you can click on that link, and it'll take you right to the event, and you can register that way. That is April 22nd and 23rd. All right, well, we are in 1 Kings chapter 8. First verse, wrapped up chapter 7. We got to hear all the details about the inside of the temple, the outside of the temple, a lot of water going on, a lot of imagery going on. And now Solomon has got to assemble some elders and heads of the tribes together, and time to bring the ark home.
Yeah, so 1 Kings 8 is a pretty fascinating chapter. There's a very long prayer that we're going to get to in just a minute, but it's all focused upon what Solomon has to say to the people, what he has to say to God, and then a ton of sacrifices at the end of the chapter. So it's a pretty fascinating chapter because of the centrality of the temple and the theology that's connected with it. So we'll be getting to that, especially when we get to the prayer. But I think it's a great example of how everything changes after this. We touched on that last week, that with the coming of the temple, everything does change after that. I mean, you never get away from the centrality of the temple throughout the rest of the Old Testament. Everything in 1st and 2nd Kings is going to be how the kings reign in accord with the temple and the sacrifices. And then you have the destruction of the temple, the reconstruction of the temple in Ezra and Nehemiah. And then, of course, the temple is going to be central in the New Testament as well. But I think what strikes me most about this chapter is how everything that describes the temple is in one way or another connected back to the promise to David, 2 Samuel 7. So that's going to loom large. And then to the Exodus. The Exodus comes up multiple times in this chapter as well. So kind of got that backward look in this chapter. At the same time, you've got a forward look, because a lot of what is said about the temple is going to feed into our understanding of Christology. So we'll be going backwards and we'll be going forwards as we work our way through the chapter.
Chad, are you saying that it's going to feed into Christology because the Word became flesh and tabernacled, dwelt among us? In 70 AD, which is like a huge date in Christian history that every Christian should know, when there is no longer any temple at all, we're not going to need one specifically because of Christ. And so the temple has a lot to say about Christology. Is this what you're alluding to?
That would be what I was alluding to. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of Old Testament Christology that informs our understanding of the person of Christ. I mean, everything from all the messenger of the Lord, angel of the Lord stuff that we've talked about a lot of different times. And, the kingship, the priesthood, there's a lot of streams that feed into the Christological river, let's put it that way, from the Old Testament.
I did see, and I know this is a complete aside, but since we're talking about Christology in the Old Testament, I did see you make a reference earlier this week about a New York Times article where they had to print a retraction. I guess it was a retraction where they apologized for insinuating that Jesus was present in the Old Testament, which of course he was not. And you instructed them that they need to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, I'm still waiting on that phone call from the New York Times where I can straighten out the Old Testament Christology. I'm sure they just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah. I'm guessing that 1 Kings chapter 8, though, is not one of the texts they thought you might go to.
Probably not. Yeah, but I Yeah, I think of all these smaller streams feeding into that Christological river of the New Testament, the biggest one is the temple. I mean, here you have the immanence and transcendence brought together. So that, of course, the temple is very imminent. It's right there. You can see it. And it is toward that temple that you pray, because that's where God's put his name. At the same time, there's some transcendence going on, because God hears in heaven, as we will hear in just a minute. But what happens in the incarnation is both these things are brought together. So the body of Christ is imminent. I mean, it's right there. You can see it. You can touch it. And at the same time, he is, as Paul will say to Colossians, that in him all the fullness of the Godhead dwells bodily. So there's no longer like the temple on earth and God in heaven. In the incarnation, they're both. So there's the temple, there's God. So that everything about God is in Christ. Everything, we have no God apart from the flesh and blood of Christ in his temple. So 1 Kings 8 is going to give us that necessary backdrop for grasping what a continuation, yes, of the whole temple Christology, but then also something radically new, because now you have heaven and earth joined together in this one person. We'll be fleshing that out more as we go along. We're gonna start out here with getting everybody together. That's how 1 Kings 8:1 starts. Solomon gathers all the elders of Israel, got the tribal heads, got the leaders of the father's houses. So all these representatives from the 12 tribes, brings them to Jerusalem. And what they're going to do is they're going to finally, this has been going on for a long time now, they're going to finally bring together all the various parts of the tabernacle. Because remember, at one point, you had this weird divorce. You had the Ark of the Covenant in one place, and you had the tent itself somewhere else. And now they're finally, after this strange separation, they're finally going to be brought back together. It's almost a resurrection, if you will. So you have the tabernacle divided, and now it's going to be brought back into this living unity once more in the temple, which is a great parallel to John 2. Destroy this temple, in 3 days I will rebuild it. Well, this is the regathering of these scattered parts of the tabernacle into one place. So they're going to bring the ark from out of the city of David, and they're going to bring it up to Mount Moriah, which is where the temple has been constructed. So remember that if you visit Jerusalem today, which God willing, I will be doing in like 3 or 4 weeks, the goal is to visit if international laws and COVID allows us to do. So when we go there, we will see that you got the city of David. The city of David is a separate area in Jerusalem, lower in elevation. And now what they've done is they've gone upward to Mount Moriah. So literally moving upward to a higher elevation, which is where the tabernacle was built, where the temple was constructed. So they're going to go from the city of David, also called Zion here, and they're going to move everything up into its new headquarters, into its new temple. So everybody gets together. Verse 2 says, all these people assembled to King Solomon, and it was at a very specific time. They got there at the feast in the month of Ethanim, which is the 7th month. Now, this is significant because Israel had three national festivals, to which all the male Israelites were required to come. The first one was Passover, which, of course, is in the spring. Second one is 50 days later, Pentecost, or weeks, as it's called in the Old Testament. So those are both in the spring, early summer. And the third one is Sukkot, or tabernacles, or booths, is sometimes called. And that one is in the fall, September, October, which in the Israelite calendar would be the 7th month. So the 7th month and this feast that they're talking about, at which all of Israel gathers, is the Feast of Tabernacles, or booths, in the 7th month. Now, the reason this is perfectly fitting is because the Festival of Booths, or Tabernacles, or Sukkot, all the same thing, what it commemorated was when the Israelites were leaving Egypt in the wilderness and living in tents, living in little tabernacles. And so what would happen every year when they came to the Feast of Tabernacles is the Israelites would actually live in these temporary shelters were made from various kinds of vegetation. as a way of actively remembering when they were living in these temporary shelters during the 40 years of wandering. Well, now, think of this. They're coming to Jerusalem, and what are they celebrating? They're celebrating the fact that God is no longer tabernacling. God's no longer in a temporary shelter. God is moving into his temple. And at the same time, they're also celebrating the fact that the Exodus is now over. All these times of wandering and waiting for God to establish his permanent abode in Israel have come to an end. And so they're coming to Jerusalem in the seventh month for the Feast of Tabernacles. But that what they're celebrating is the end of God's tabernacling and the beginning of his templing in the midst of his people.
Yeah, that part is really interesting because you almost see this reversal when Jesus comes on the scene. And of course, John spells this out really clearly. Where here, as the temple is built, they're celebrating sort of the end of God having to dwell in a tabernacle dwelling. So when people hear tabernacle, I think that sometimes they think of some kind of, I think they think of a temple a lot of the time, which is not at all. Like, right. You're talking about all kinds of people tabernacled. That's why the Feast of Tabernacles, like, how many tabernacles were there? Well, there was a lot of them. There was a lot of people.
Everyone had one.
So you got a tent, Chad's got a tent, I got a tent, and God had a tent. And they're celebrating that God no longer is sort of in a tent just like them and living the same way they're living. He's got a better place, a more appropriate place. And when John starts out his gospel, he says that something different has happened. So here they're celebrating God moving from the tabernacle to the temple. And John starts out his gospel and says God has now moved from the temple back into the tabernacle. And this is the word here, that God has been... that the word became flesh and tabernacled among us again, almost. That he is now in our midst again, just like us. He's living in the same thing that we're living in, which is a body.
Yeah. Paul picks up on that imagery in 1 Corinthians 15 when he talks about our earthly tabernacle, our earthly tent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our bodies. Yeah. So that's a great insight. And you can kind of see that in the whole pattern of the ministry of John the Baptist, too, where... he brings the people, it's kind of like a reversal. He takes people backward. He's like, hey, I want you to come into the wilderness. So you've been in the land all these centuries. Well, I want you to reverse that. I want you to come out of Jerusalem or come out of wherever you're at, and I want you to go back into the desert, back into the wilderness where everything began. It's what Hosea talks about when he talks about how when the Messiah comes, he's going to woo his people back into the wilderness. So there's a sense, a restart that needs to take place. So he brings them back into the wilderness. And then just as Israel crossed the Jordan River under Joshua, so now they're going to be baptized in the Jordan River under John and, of course, Jesus. And then they are going to be ready now for what is to come. And what is to come? Well, what they're celebrating now is God has tabernacled. So there's a kind of a sense in which the ministry of Jesus is a reversal. It's going back. But it's going back in order to bring people forward into the Messianic kingdom.
Yeah, that part is weird. You know, John calling people out to the wilderness, and what's he called them out there for? Well, it's going to be baptized and stuff, but who's going to show up there? God.
Yeah.
You got to go out into the wilderness and witness the baptism of God.
Yeah. What's more, you have the Ark of the Covenant in the Jordan River.
Right.
Except this time it's the... it's a real ark. It's a real ark of the covenant. It's Yahweh himself in flesh and blood.
Yeah. So one thing that's fun about this is seeing the beginning, you know, reading about the excitement about something that you know is just a shadow of something else that's going to also be reversed. And so you get to see the beginning of something that you know God means to bring to fulfillment and end.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a kind of joyful incompleteness about so much of the Old Testament. It's like you rejoice because this is great or that is great. Well, yes, because these are gifts of God. You know, the tabernacle construction is great. Temple construction is great. Priesthood is great. But they're all divinely designed to be incomplete.
Right.
They're not that, they don't bring us to that telos, to use that Greek word that the New Testament often uses. And that's what Hebrews says, right? Priesthood is great, but not perfect. Tabernacle, great, but not perfect. Sacrifices, great, but not perfect. They're all actually designed to be imperfect.
Yeah, and they're almost like too incredible too, right? Like you read about the temple and you're like, man, that is great. Like that's impressive, and people are gonna come from all over the place and think it's amazing. And we just went through like what it looks like and what all it took, and you're like, that's incredible. And of course, it's just like God to be like, yeah, that is good, and I'm gonna be there for a little while, but man, just wait till you see this homeless guy wandering through the desert. Like that's gonna be. That's where it's at right there, man. You haven't seen nothing yet.
Greatest man who ever lived. Yeah. so back to verse 3. So we've got everybody together. So what's going to happen next? Well, elders come, priests take up the ark. So they brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. So all the holy stuff, all the sacred elements of the tabernacle. The priests and Levites brought him up. And then we have King Solomon, all the congregation, everybody's assembled before him, and they go with the ark. And there are a lot of animals being sacrificed here. In fact, they didn't even keep track, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. A lot of sacrifices taking place during this procession. Then the priest brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house in the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark so that the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they couldn't be seen from the outside. And they are there, we're told, to this day. Now, I don't know exactly what to make of that, but my impression is that, okay, we got the old original Ark of the Covenant, so that was not redone. It wasn't like Solomon said, you know what? We got a bigger sanctuary. We need a bigger ark. No, ark is still the same. Same ark this whole time. And presumably, this is kind of one of the oddities about this whole scenario to me. So presumably, you've got, of course, the old chest, which is what the ark is. You got the mercy seat, the place of atonement on top of it, to which is attached the original cherubim. So you remember how this all looked. You get the chest, you get the gold plate on top of it, the cherubim are attached to it. You got poles on the other side for carrying it. So you're going to take the old chest, place of atonement, cherubim, and you're going to move them into this place where there's like these monstrosity cherubim, look like Egyptian sphinxes that are inside there. So now you're going to have, I guess, four cherubim. You got the two big ones, you got the little ones that are already attached to the place of atonement. And it's all going to be moved into this space that has been prepared for them. And then the poles by which the ark was carried, remember, you don't just like grab the chest on the corner or something.
Yeah, we know not to do that. We learned.
Yeah, talk to Uzzah. You don't touch that. So evidently they're so long that maybe there's a gap at the edge of the entrance to the Holy of Holies where the poles can be seen if you're in the holy place. And that's the way I'm envisioning this anyway. I mean, I don't know if that rings true with you or not, Dan, but that's kind of, I'm listening, that's the way that it seems everything's working. And then we're told, verse 9, what was in the ark. We knew this already, but it's reaffirmed. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb Sinai, same place, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. So you got, that's why it's called, as probably everyone knows, that's why it's called the Ark of the Covenant, because it contained the tablets of the covenant. So ark is just a fancy word for a chest, a receptacle. And so it was a receptacle for the words of the covenant, the 10 words that were placed within it. So basically the Articles of the Covenant were kept in this holy place, which, by the way, is a very widespread ancient Near Eastern idea. If you have some kind of treaty, that treaty would be written up, and then the articles, whether it's papyrus or parchment or stone or whatever the treaty was written on, would be deposited within a holy place. So that's what's happening here. The Articles of the Covenant, written tablets of stone, are deposited in this holy place. And then verse 10 is the end of this first section, tells us that when the priest came out of the holy place, so after they've moved everything in there, the priest exit, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Now, this is a direct reference back to what happened when the tabernacle itself was dedicated. So once the tabernacle was finished, at the very end of the book of Exodus, chapter 40, where you read this, this is Exodus 40, 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So basically, this is the same song, second verse. So as it happened at the tabernacle, so now it happens at the temple. And this was God's way of ratifying the fact that he has now placed his name there. He's taken up residence within this earthly house, signified, of course, by the cloud or the glory, basically referring to the same thing.
This had to be a pretty affirming moment for Solomon, right? So you go through all this work. I mean, remember, this is years and years of work now that you've done. What you don't want to happen is for you to finish it and then this not to happen.
Yeah.
And you're wondering,
and you're like, looking for clouds, and no cloud shows up.
Well, just you're wondering, like, did God show up? Like, is he pleased with this thing? So this has got to be, you know, big sigh of relief from Solomon that God has indeed decided to dwell in the temple that you have built for him.
Yeah, that'd be a pretty big letdown.
Yeah.
you engage in all this time and work and expense, and then no clouds show up.
Yeah,
what did you do wrong?
People are like, is God living there? You're like, don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we hope. We hope he is. So that is through verse 11. So that's all descriptive, of course, of the procession and the sacrifices and whatnot. Well, now Solomon's going to talk. And Solomon has a lot to say in this chapter. So he's going to begin by not praying, but he's speaking here, speaking presumably to the gathered people about what this all means. This is his way of referring back to some previous events and promises, and now showing that they are at least partially fulfilled in what's happening today. So Solomon said, verse 12, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. I have indeed built you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell in forever." Now, let me pause here just for a second. The reason that's important, that phrase, "a place for you to dwell in Hebrew, makon leshivtika, that exact phrase is lifted from Exodus 15, verse 17. So Exodus 15 is the song at the sea. Exodus 14 is when Israel crosses the Red Sea on dry ground. God brings the waters down, destroys Pharaoh and the Egyptians. On the other side, Moses and the Israelites, under the leadership of Miriam, sing the song at the sea. And at the end of the song at the sea, so it goes through, you know, God does this at the Red Sea, destroys the enemies, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of the song at the sea, here's what we read. This is Exodus 15, 17. "You will bring them in," talking about the people of Israel, "you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain." Of course, we know now, they didn't know then, but we know that that is Mount Moriah. "You will plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode." Now that Hebrew phrase, which translated "the place which you have made for your abode," makon leshivtika, is the exact phrase that is now used by Solomon at the dedication of this house. So this is Solomon's way of saying what is happening now here at this place is a fulfillment of what Israel had sung about at the Song of the Sea generations before. So now, finally, this mountain and this place that God has chosen to make his abode have come to their fulfillment. So the reason I point that out is because this is Solomon's way of basically saying this poetic prophecy, if you want to call it, in Exodus 15 is now fulfilled. It's fulfilled here and now in this place. "So I built you an exalted house. I have made you a place to dwell in forever." And then the king turns around and he blesses the Israelites. And here's what he said. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his hand has fulfilled what he promised with his mouth to David, my father. So this is a reference back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Since the day that I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house, that my name might be there. But I chose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to David, my father, whereas it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. So, yeah, that was a good idea. But nevertheless, you shall not build a house, but your son who shall be born to you shall build a house for my name. Verse 20, now the Lord has fulfilled his promise that he made. For I have risen in the place of my father David, sit on David's throne, on Israel's throne, as the Lord promised. And I built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I provided a place for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. So you hear in those verses a whole lot of language of basically promise fulfillment. God said to David, it's great you want to build a house, but you're not going to do it. Your son's going to do it. Solomon says, I've done it. God promised that he was going to raise up this son. Solomon says, I am that son. God has fulfilled it. So as we'll see a lot in 1st and 2nd Kings, a major concern of these books is that the promises that God made are being fulfilled, whether negative or positive. And in this case, they're all positive. God said he'd do this for David, and he's done it. It's being fulfilled this day.
This might be just me. This is all great because you're talking about the promises of God being fulfilled. So God has said things, and those things have happened. And yet, like, it is difficult to read these things without sensing this tone in Solomon where he believes he has really done, like, because there's a lot of God promised this and I have done it stuff.
There's a lot of eyes in here.
There's a lot of eyes in this particular speech here. It's not that God has promised to build that his son would build a house and he has kept his promise. There is God said this and I fulfilled that. And God said this about David. And I have done that. Even just saying, you know, I have built a place for you to dwell in forever. Well, that's not even true. That's like quite the assumption that this temple is going to be there forever, right? And so while this is great, because what it really is a fulfillment, God fulfilling all his promises, Solomon does seem interested in the people knowing that he has really been involved in the God keeping of his promises.
What a central role he has played.
Like I said, that might be just me, but I'm like, man, there's a lot of eyes in this speech.
No, I don't think it's just you. I think it reveals the fact that Solomon certainly, this is beyond dispute, certainly does not have the grand and complete picture in mind here. Because we know, if you go back to 2 Samuel 7, a lot of the promises that God made to David in that chapter could not be fulfilled in Solomon.
Right.
Because Solomon is not going to sit on the throne of his father David forever.
Right.
Which is what God promised. So this is a case, I may have a few of these in the Old Testament. This is a case where God makes a promise and there is, as it were, a partial fulfillment or a temporary fulfillment of it, but by no means the complete fulfillment of it. So is Solomon the son and seed of David? Yeah, but he's not the capital T son of David. Did he build a house for God? Well, yeah, but this isn't the house that God wants eventually. So is there a fulfillment here? Yeah, but it's not nearly what Solomon thinks that it is. This is going to pale in comparison with what God has in mind for the messianic future.
Right. Yeah, you kind of see it in these last words, you know, as of this part where he says, and there I have provided a place for the ark. Even that, you build this thing for God, and this is, and you're supposed to be filled with awe and reverence and fear and all of these things. You seems like you could say something like, and now there is a place for the ark to dwell.
Yeah.
Like I would, but he doesn't say that. He's like, I have provided this for the Lord. Like that language is just like jerks your ear a little bit where you're like, that is wild. Like as opposed to just saying there now is a place, there is now a temple. Like, and, you would seem like, as you're talking about a home for God, that you might have to give the speech, but you would want to let other lips praise you in this particular moment.
Well, isn't it a great example? And this is a teachable moment, I think, for all of us, that just because somebody in the Old Testament says something, like a king or, you know, maybe a priest or David, or, I mean, we've seen other examples of this, where somebody said something, and maybe it's in a prayer, that doesn't mean that everything that this person says is exactly what God would want them to say.
No.
So it wasn't like this was a scroll that fell from heaven into Solomon's hand, and he stood up and he read it word for word because this is exactly what God had given him to say. Now, this is, keep in mind, this is Solomon's prayer. And is most of it great? Well, yeah. I mean, but that doesn't mean it's a perfect prayer. It's a prayer spoken by an imperfect person.
Yeah, this is the word of God, but these aren't God's words. These are Solomon's words recorded in the word of God.
Yes, that's precisely right. Yeah. And I mean, we have other examples of this too. The one that comes immediately to mind, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but it popped into my head, and I've written about it in my forthcoming book about Jacob, and that is Jacob's prayer. So this is right before he meets Esau, and he's praying to God that God would protect him, because of course he's scared about his reunion with Esau. And in one part of the prayer, so let me back up. So Jacob has separated all his people into two camps before this, just for means of protection. And in his prayer, Jacob sounds all pious. And he says, "Oh God, I thank you that you have richly supplied me so that I now have two parties." Well, the reason he has two parties is because he split his group up. It has nothing to do with divine blessing. This was Jacob's practical defensive position. But he makes it sound in his prayer as if, "Oh God, you've given me so much money and I now have two parties." Well, no, you just made that decision. So, I mean, that just one example, but it's an example where somebody prays, a patriarch in this case, but that doesn't mean everything he says in his prayer is God's words to him. It just is his words to God. And it's like that here with Solomon as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So now Solomon's going to pray, and he's going to assume the typical posture of prayer in the Bible. So he stands before the altar. He's in front of all this assembly of Israel. And we're told that he spread out his hands toward heaven. I don't really know where this, you know, today, what's a typical prayer posture? People fold their hands and they bow their head and they close their eyes. Interestingly, in the scriptures, it doesn't work that way. And I'm not sure how we kind of came to this particular prayer posture, but over and over, at least in the Old Testament, the posture of prayer is the way Solomon prays here. So hands are outspread. Usually palms are lifted up toward heaven. It's the posture of reception, basically.
Yeah, so you're usually receive. Yeah, in the Old Testament, certainly it seems that your head is up, your hands are open. We do the exact opposite. The head is down.
Yeah, it's like we do the exact opposite. We don't look up, we look down. We don't spread out our hands. We put them together, and we don't open our eyes. We close them.
Yeah.
it's a very, I don't know. I mean, if you want to pray that way, fine. I mean, I pray that way many times too, but it just is strange to me that the explicit description of the posture of prayer in the Bible is we do the exact opposite of that now.
There's moments in the scriptures where you have people fall to their knees sort of stuff, but certainly prayers of thanksgiving or anything like that, this was not done.
No, that's mainly, you'll have people fall on the knees or they'll completely prostrate themselves, but you also have people standing. So the body itself can do a number of things, stand up straight, kneel, or prostrate oneself. But, you know, the hands and the eyes are almost always, palms are spread. We have examples of that, Exodus, Ezra, and the Psalms. I will lift up my hands to the sanctuary. So it's really if you actually do that right now, so you lift up your hands, palms upward. Well, it's an openness. It's a receptive pose, which is, of course, what this prayer is all about. So he does that, and then he begins to pray, and he says, "O Lord God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on the earth beneath." No God in what way? Well, one who keeps covenant and shows steadfast love, shows chesed to your servants who walk before you with all their heart. So there's no God like you because you're the God, you keep your covenant, and you show this chesed to your people. And then he goes on to refer to his father again. You've kept with your servant David, my father, what you declared to him. So you fulfilled what you said to him. You spoke with your mouth and with your hand have fulfilled it this day.
Now,
so
I like
what you
this.
Said is what you did.
I like this prayer a lot better than this speech.
Yeah, the prayer. Yeah, this is good. Yeah, yeah, this is you said this with your mouth. Now you're doing it with your hand.
Yeah, this is great. This is exactly how you want to theologically interpret you doing something for God.
So he goes on, you, O Lord, God of Israel, you keep for your servant David, my father, what you promised, that he shall not like a man who sits on his throne, if only your sons pay close attention to their way to walk before me as you have walked before me. Well, that if is going to be significant, of course, because the very man who's speaking this is not going to do what he is saying the sons of David should do. But we'll see that down the road. Now, therefore, God of Israel, let your word be confirmed, which you have spoken to your servant David, my father. Okay, so, yeah, good introduction, basically describing God as a God of covenant faithfulness, a God of chesed, and a God who doesn't just make promises, but actually keeps his promises. He's a God of his word.
Yeah, so you see in this prayer to God, when sort of this heading in the previous thing where Solomon blesses the Lord, but he's sort of saying this in public, and that one it like we said, that one hits a little weird seems like there's some flexing going on. Mm-hmm. Now Solomon's praying directly to the Lord, and God's now getting credit for everything, which is exactly how you want it to be.
That is the way that you want it to be. So we'll wrap up here with this last section, and we might actually come back to it next episode, but because it is significant. Verse 27, but, so I've said all this, I've built all this. And then Solomon says, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built? Now, this might be the best thing that Solomon has said
so far.
Yeah,
this is nice. You almost wonder if he came to a realization after surgery. He's like, man, I don't know if that came out exactly the way it should have. let me try again.
Self-editing here as I go along. Yeah. Now, this is, we probably will have to come back to this just because it's so important. This is a great distinction here. I mean, this in one verse kind of captures a lot of the tension that we feel in the Old Testament between, okay, is God with his people, Israel? Yes. Is God such that the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain him? Also, yes. So when God sends his messenger, like at the burning bush or to Hagar or whatever, is this God? Yes. But at the same time, did God send this messenger? Also, yes. So there's this constant struggle in the Old Testament between what theologians will call the transcendence of God, the immanence of God. And Solomon captures this here. So he's built a house for God, yes. But then he says, but will God dwell on the earth? Because, even the heavens can't contain him. So if the heavens can't contain him, then certainly this house, relatively small structure in Jerusalem, cannot contain him. And yet, at the same time, God has promised to be there. So it is God's house. But at the same time, God is much bigger than his house.
Yeah, I love this moment because Solomon says, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? And the answer to that question is,
he knew.
Yes, he will.
Yes,
and his reason for asking this is, the highest heavens cannot contain you, much less this house. You're like, how about a person?
Yeah.
Like, how about we shrink it down even smaller? Just into a man, and have that be how God will indeed dwell on the earth.
Then his rhetorical question becomes an actual question, to which the answer is, yep, God will dwell on the earth.
Yeah. Solomon is not thinking too small with his house. He's thinking much too big.
He's thinking too big, right? Yeah. So, because eventually, within a manger is going to be all of God.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Not a third of God, not 99% of God, but the whole fullness of the deity dwells there.
Yeah.
As an infant, bodily.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. We will definitely have to, well, I'm sure we're going to have to come back to this, verse 27 and on next week. And
like, yeah, it'll be a good segue point to, the rest of what he has to say there. And then the seven petitions that, seven situations that are going to come up in the rest of the chapter.
Awesome. Well, all right, man. Looking forward to it. And, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.